Allow me just a moment here at the beginning to just say a word of appreciation to the disciples who make up the New Caney Church. You have been so kind to me this week we have spent together. I've enjoyed the good meals we've shared and the visits we've had and the time we've had to get to know each other better. So grateful for every act of kindness that you have extended to me. But mostly, I appreciate the obvious interest that you have in God and in His will. That's been evidenced by your presence each night, the fact that you weren't just here to fill a pew, but that you were listening and engaged. You know, we can kind of sense that when we're up here preaching, when folks are with us and when they're not. You've been with me this week, and you've had good things to say about the lessons, and I am so grateful for that. It's good to be with Charles and Dee again and get to renew our friendship. You know, as I mentioned, we've been friends a long, long time, as Dee knows, since today's her birthday. And so she's really marking those years that have passed since we were all together up in Huntsville. But it's been great to be with them again. Appreciate so much their good work here with you and the way you are working together to do things for the cause of Christ here in this area. Appreciate that so much. And thank you for letting me be with you this week. I will tell you in advance that the lesson tonight will be a little bit different. I want to begin by telling you a story, and I will warn you in advance that it's going to take a while to tell you the whole story. I think when we get done, you'll appreciate that we needed to get through the whole thing. And then when we're done with that, I'm going to call on three scriptures to make three applications of the story, and then we're going to be finished with our study this evening. The story I want to tell you centers around some events that took place in the Little East Texas town of Haslam. Normally when I tell this story, I'm talking to people who have no clue where Haslam, Texas is. Maybe some of you do. It's right along our border with Louisiana up in the northeast part of the state, just across the river from Logansport, Louisiana. It's one of those places that just sort of epitomizes small town life in America. It's really a wide spot in the road where people go to bed at night and don't bother to check whether the doors are locked, and they're going to pull up at the convenience store, and if they're just going to run in real quick, they might leave the keys in the ignition, they might leave the motor running, because that's just how it is in towns like Haslam. You don't worry about crime and things like that. But in late March of 1987, that small town spirit was shattered by a horrific murder. Carl Rinkel owned one of the local grocery stores in Haslam, and on 6 o'clock Sunday morning, his employees all arrived at the store expecting him to be there to open for them, but he wasn't there. And they knew immediately something was wrong because Carl was always there to open the store. And so they went looking for him, and they went to the most logical place. They went back to his house first, and it was there that they could peek inside the carport door that was standing a little bit open, and they could see his dead body lying in the living room where he had been murdered the night before. Of course, in a little town like Haslam, something like that immediately just grabbed everybody's attention. It was the lead story in the local newspaper, and everybody in town was talking about it. In fact, they weren't just talking about it. The people were terrified. They were wondering, who could have done such a thing in our little town? Things like that don't happen here. And they lived in fear until they figured out who had done this and arrested them. I visited Haslam about 3 years after Carl's murder and went across the river to Logansport and was talking to the librarian there. And oh, she said, I remembered after Carl was killed. And she shared with me some of the fears that she had. In fact, she said, after Carl's murder, I started making sure my doors were locked when I went to bed at night. Of course, innocent people being brutally killed, that kind of thing is all too common in our culture, especially in our larger cities. And so even if you were around in 1987 and old enough to remember what was going on, you probably never heard anything about this story. I lived about 100 miles, 150 miles from Haslam when that happened, and I didn't learn of Carl's murder until much after the fact. It was back when me and my wife and Charles and Dee were all together in Huntsville, Texas, 20-some-odd years ago. We won't go into the math. I was involved in my first local work as a gospel preacher with a little church in Huntsville, Texas. And while I was working there, late one night, I got a call. It was 9, 10 o'clock at night from a man that I didn't know at all. And so when he first called, he began by introducing himself, giving me his name, and explaining how he had run me down through several different connections that we had with each other. And when he explained all that, he said, Brother David, I've called because I need you to do something for me. And then he paused. And it was that sort of awkward pause that just kind of leaves you wondering what's coming next. And after the pause, he said that his son had just been convicted of capital murder in Shelby County. And they were sending him off to the Ellis unit right there in the Huntsville area, where he was to await his execution at what we used to be called Walls Unit right in downtown Huntsville. And he said, I'm just looking for somebody that will go out to the prison and study with my son and help him get his life straightened out. And I've been trying to track someone down and you're there. So I wanted to know if you'd go. How do you say no to a request like that? And so not knowing anything about what I was getting myself into, I told the guy that I would try to go see his son. And it was after several weeks of arranging that first visit that I came to learn of the murder of Carl Rinkel and to meet the man who killed him. That man's name was Ricky Blackmon. I will tell you that Ricky was not at all what I anticipated when I went to meet him that very first time. I want you to know, even though I was a young man, I went into that meeting with some presuppositions about what kind of person could do such a terrible, terrible thing. The problem was that as he and I sat there and visited for that first two-hour meeting in the little visiting room at the Ellis unit, I quickly discovered that he didn't fit in my box. That he didn't fit any of my presuppositions. Ricky didn't grow up in an inner city where he was surrounded by gangs and the violence and chaos that goes with all of that, so that this kind of lifestyle, this violent lifestyle, were just something that were sort of ingrained in him. He didn't grow up with an abusive mother and father who mistreated him. He wasn't crazy, to the best that I was able to determine. In fact, the truth is that as he and I sat there that first time and got acquainted with each other, I quickly began to discover that his upbringing wasn't all that different from mine. Ricky grew up in Mount Pleasant, Texas. Y'all have heard of that, right? About another 2 or 3 hours up in northeast Texas, not far from Haslam. His mom and dad were members of the Southside Church of Christ there in Mount Pleasant and were faithful members of that congregation. And when Ricky was a young man, he went there with his parents. In fact, his dad was sort of a preacher. When I say sort of, I don't mean that he wasn't very good. I mean that he did other work during the week, but sometimes on the weekends he would preach. There was a little wide spot out from Mount Pleasant called Cooper's Chapel, Texas. And Cooper's Chapel, I've learned later, was actually Ricky's family's homestead. They go back generations and generations on this little plot of ground. And he's got kinfolk scattered out all around this little church building and the cemetery next to it, as it used to be. And back in the late 70s and early 80s, there were still a small group of our brethren, a lot of Ricky's kinfolks, that used to meet on Sundays in that old frame church building. And if you're wondering, no, there's not any air conditioning. In fact, there's not even any padded pews in that old building, but they still gathered there and they worshiped. Can you imagine what that was like in July? Warm. And when Ricky was 15 years old, he would go out when his daddy would go to preach, and his dad would do the preaching, and Ricky would go and he'd lead the singing for this little group. As I walked around that old church building, I would tell you, I could just get in my mind's eye the image of that 15-year-old boy sitting down there on the front pew, waiting for his dad to save the words that would be his cue to rise and lead the church in the invitation song. Can you see that in your mind? And I think like never before, I was struck with a sense, those are not the kind of roots from which killers So how does the son of a part-time preacher end up on death row? I don't know that I can give you a simple answer to that question. Maybe that's because there isn't one, but I can tell you how Ricky answered that question. He always began that explanation in exactly the same place. He said, I need to go back to the time that I was 15 years old and I was starting high school and I was trying to fit in and looking for a crowd that I could connect with. And he said, my problems are really simple. I just connected with the wrong crowd. I want to be accepted by a group of boys who were into the wrong things, drinking and then drugs and that kind of thing. In fact, I could better let him say it in his own words. In one of the letters he wrote to me, he said this. He said, before I knew it, I was in with the ways of the world. I'm talking about sex, dope, drinking, and thinking my parents didn't know what they were talking about, telling me not to do this or that. But as I look, but I did not like someone telling me how to run my life. But as I look back on it now, my friends were running my life. And I was having fun the way they did. And it seemed I had control. But as I look back now, I see that I was wrong. It was all about that crowd and wanting to make them happy. And so when they began to pressure him to smoke and then to drink and to use drugs because that's who was important to him, he just fell into step with that. And began a long slide that took him away from the Lord. He continued to run with that crowd well into his adult life. Ran with the worst kind of people, used and abused every kind of drug, lived a life of sexual immorality. In fact, he described for me what was the decade of his 20s. He said it was sort of a cycle. He said, I'd go out and I'd get a job doing whatever I could get hired to do, and I'd work that job for a little while, and I'd save every dime that I didn't have to eat. And he said, I'd do that for 2 or 3 months, and when I had a little bit of money set aside, I'd quit the job, and I would go party. And if some of you older folks are thinking that means birthday cake and candles, that's not the kind of party we're talking about, okay? When he talks about partying, what he means is that he would go find friends and they would buy drugs and they'd get high day and night until all the money run out, and then he'd go find something else to do, and he'd work that job for a little while and he would continue that cycle. So he's always in and out of debt, making a little money and then using it all up. Until March of 1987, when he was on the downside of that cycle, things were so bad that he was living at the state park in a tent, and when it got too cold, sleeping in his car. And out of money to buy drugs. But he was with a woman who said that she knew how they could get some quick money to buy drugs, because back in her hometown of Haslam, she knew a guy who owned a grocery store that always had a bunch of money on him. And so now you know the connection and how this story goes. Ricky and I continued to study together for about 3 years while I continued my work in Huntsville, Texas. And then I later moved off to Chicago and then Orlando. And he and I would see each other occasionally and correspond back and forth. But it was in July of 1999 that I received this letter from him. I guess from the very first meeting that he knew one day he'd have to write it, and I knew one day that I would get it. The letter read, Dear David and family, how are you? Fine, I hope and pray. Myself, I am very nervous. I am in touch with the Lord this day more so than I have ever been. My heart feels like I can't get it to pump enough blood, and my hand feels like it wants to start shaking, but I'm holding fast to the word of the Lord. Just today, I was informed of my execution date. I will go to be with the saints who are waiting for the day of judgment on August 4th, 1999. Well, brother, I'm sorry this letter is so short, but I have much people to tell this to, so take care and remain strong as I am trying to do. God bless you. Love, Ricky Don. On Wednesday, August the 4th, 1999, the state of Texas executed Ricky Blackmon for the murder of Carl Rinkle. I was living in Orlando at that time, but I had a chance to go back out to Texas and to be with him for those last 3 days and then to be with him when he died. Those were interesting days. A lot of stuff to talk about. A lot of plans to make. But if there was one thought that dominated our conversation over all three of those days that we kept coming back to again and again, it was his desire that his story would be told, that maybe he might be able to help somebody else. He had a special passion for young people. He would be so delighted that there was a whole crowd of kids in the house tonight hearing his story. I don't think it's hard to figure out why he had a passion for kids. It's because he saw so many of his problems as beginning when he was your age. As I think back on all the time he and I spent visiting through that little window at the Ellis Unit, it occurs to me that I have heard Ricky Blackmon preach a lot of different sermons. And so I'm going to make a confession tonight that I'm going to plagiarize my friend and use some of his material. Since he can't be here to preach to the crowd, I'd like to preach some of his sermons for you. It's okay, I have his permission. I want to preach some of his sermons because I think he says some things that God would want to say to us. And because if you will allow me to do that, you will help me keep a promise to a friend that we would tell his story. And that maybe out of the tragedy that was his life, maybe along the way, some good thing might come from it. So if he could be here and he could speak to this crowd, what kinds of things would Ricky say that he would want us to learn from his life? Let me begin with this. I have 3 points I want to make, 3 applications from his story. Number one, I think if he could be here, he would want to say to us, don't run with the wrong crowd. And I think he would especially want to say to the young people in the crowd, be very careful about the people that you choose to surround yourself with. You're grabbing your Bibles, great. Go over and get to 1 Corinthians 15. We're going to get there in just a second and making our application. Even knowing just a little bit of the story that you know, is it any surprise to see that up there? I begin here because this is where he would begin. It's the sermon I heard him preach more frequently than any other, and it's not hard to figure out why. That from his perspective, this is where his problems began. And I want you to get your mind around that. Here is a guy that went to death row, and he says, if you want to know where it all turned for me, it was when I was 15 years old and I made choices, bad choices, about my friends. That's pretty impressive, isn't it? In fact, in one of the letters he wrote to me, he said, I was baptized at 15 years old and I helped my dad by leading singing every Sunday. As I got older, I started to have friends that were not Christians and some of the things that they did were fun. Some of the things I didn't want to do, but my friends would say, come on, it won't hurt you, or what's the matter, you're scared. And after a while, it was okay, so I thought. I started smoking cigarettes because my friends did. I started drinking because they did. And when I was in the 9th grade, I was introduced to smoking dope because my friends said, oh, you'll like it. And I did. Before I knew it, I was in with the ways of the world. Do you see it? You see it in his letter? He said, it's about this crowd of people, the wrong people that he pulled close and came to value. In fact, the truth is he came to value that crowd more than his own convictions, things that he's grown up his whole life believing. He came to value that crowd more than his mother and dad who had raised him, more than the people in the church where he grew up, the elders and preachers who tried to talk to him, more than even what God said to him through his word. The crowd became more important than any of that. And so what they said, that's what he did. He cared more about their approval than anything else, and for him, the results were disastrous. And so if he could stand here and he could talk to the crowd, he would want to say to every one of us, you need to be very, very careful about the crowd of people you surround yourself with as your friends. Don't run with the wrong crowd. And listen, in saying that, he's just catching up with God, because God said that a long time ago, didn't he?
1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33. Do not be deceived. Boy, anytime the Bible begins with those four words, we need to sit up and pay attention. God's saying, you may think it can be another way. Don't fool yourself about this. God says, I'm right. And if you don't agree with me, you're wrong. So listen to me on this. Do not be deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. You may be tempted to think it could be otherwise, but the bottom line is that God is right, and He says if we value the wrong people and run with the wrong crowd, they will drag us down and get us into trouble. In Proverbs chapter 1, verses 8, 9, and 10, Solomon warns his son, listen to your father and mother, verse 8. But in verse 10 he says, if sinners entice, do not consent. Whose voice are you going to listen to? It's the same issue. In John chapter 12, verses 42 and verse 43, John speaks of some in Jesus' day who loved the approval of men more than the approval of God. These were men who had heard Jesus, who had seen His miracles, and believed He was the guy. But they wouldn't confess Him. Why? Because they loved the approval of men more than the approval of God. They were worried about the consequences, worried about what the crowd would think. And unless we think that was a foolish mistake that we could never repeat, let's remember that every time we allow wicked influences to pull us into things that we know are wrong, we're doing the exact same thing those men did in John 12. We're choosing the crowd over the Christ. And when we do that, Ricky would want to say, we're headed down a road of trouble with no idea where it's going to end. He would want to say something to us about that. He would want to say that we need to choose a better crowd. He'd especially want to say that to young people, not because older people are not influenced by our peers. We are. But there does seem to be a season of life through which we pass where our crowd seems to exert an even more powerful pressure on us to conform and to go along. You've heard that before, haven't you? Have your mom and dad fussed about your friends? Have you heard lessons in Bible class and from this pulpit about being with the right crowd? I guess Ricky thought he would just add his voice to that, because coming from someone who had been where he had been, maybe that would cause you to sit up and listen. He made that bad choice to value the wrong people, and so he would warn us, don't run with the wrong crowd. But there's something else he'd want to say, especially the young people in the crowd tonight. If he could be here, I know that he would want to say something about your parents. I think he would want to say, you need to be sure that you listen to your mom and dad. You can be heading over to Ephesians 6. We're going to reference that text in just a second. While you're turning there, let me just tell you that some of the most moving conversations I had with Ricky were about his mom and dad. He loved his parents, and they loved him. They lived 9 hours away up in Oklahoma while he was in prison, and they would drive down as much as they could and come and see him. They would drive down 9 hours, and they would visit for 4 hours, and they'd turn around and drive right back 9 hours. Did you do the math on that? That's almost a whole day. And they came maybe as much as once a month at time. And they were older people. That was quite a trip for them. But they came as much as they could. They were devoted to their son. But listen, it was never enough for him. It frustrated him that he couldn't have any physical contact with them, because once an inmate goes into the death row system, he doesn't have any physical contact with the outside world ever again. So he couldn't have any physical contact with him. And it shook his faith to the core in 1993 when, while he was in prison, his dad died unexpectedly and suddenly of a heart attack. And he could not go and be by his mother's side where a son ought to be at a time like that. And nobody could be by his side to comfort him. He had to grieve alone. He loved his mom and dad. But the sad thing is that for a lengthy period of his life, he didn't really value them. He didn't really value what they said. I want you to understand that his mom and dad didn't just sort of sit on the sidelines and watch him fall off the cliff morally and spiritually and say nothing about that. What he did with his life, he did over their protest. In fact, he told me one time, in fact, he wrote in a letter, Daddy would try to tell me, you're going to get into trouble if you keep living like you are, but I didn't think so. Boy, how does that sound like some of the conversations in your house? Mom and dad say this, but I don't think so. Yeah, they had that conversation at Ricky's house too. Remember, he didn't want anybody telling him how to run his life. You know, that's usually the beginning of disaster when people say that. I still remember that first visit when he told me about his parents, watching the tears well up in his eye and roll down his cheeks as he said with regret and frustration in his voice, I wish I had listened to my dad. And so I guess he would hope that we would learn from his mistake. He would want to say to young people, if you've got a godly mom and dad trying to steer your life in the right direction, you need to listen. I'm going to let the young people in the crowd in on a little secret tonight. I always save this lesson for the last night because when I give away this secret, then they don't ever let me come back to preach. But I'm going to let you know a secret. When you go to bed at night, sometimes your mom and dad, they stay up and they go back into their room and they close the door and they talk about you. And your mom and dad plot and plan while you're asleep what they can do tomorrow to make your life more miserable. Do you know that? And if you believe that, then it's entirely probable that you're wrong about a whole lot of other stuff in life too. Your mom and dad do sometimes go back to their room after you go to bed and they do sit up and they talk about you, but what they really talk about is how to get things right with you and how to do the right thing so that things will turn out right with you. We don't always get it right as parents, but that's okay because you don't always get right doing this teenager thing either. Your mom and dad do have some benefits. They do have the benefit of experiencing life. They're a little further up life's road than you are, and they've been through some things and seen some things that give them some wisdom and insight that God commands them to impart to you. I want you to remember that. Go back to the text we've quoted in every sermon during the week, Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. What did Paul say? Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Young people need to understand that one of these days, your mom and daddy are going to go before Jesus Christ in judgment, and one of the questions he's going to ask them is, did you do for your kids what I told you to do? They'll give an account for that. It's a God-given obligation. However, I want you to notice, we've been reading the fourth verse all week. I want to go back and pick up verses 1 through 3. Because Ephesians 6, 1 says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. I think we understand the obedience thing. We've got to do what they say. That's probably drilled into our minds from the time that we're 3 months old, right? I tell you what the challenge is. It's verse 2. It's the honor thing. I told my boys growing up that means they had to obey me and like it. And I don't know that that's far from being right. To honor means to value something, to attach value to it. And what God is saying to young people is that when your mom and dad speak, when they offer counsel and guidance, that means to mean a whole lot to you. You need to treat that as something very valuable to you. Let me tell you something. If you've never changed your mind about something because of what your mom and dad said, then you don't honor your parents. That's what it means. To value what they say. I'm going to tell you something tonight. If Ricky Blackman had practiced Ephesians 6, 2, not only would he still be alive today, he wouldn't be in jail. He didn't honor his father and mother. Now, I'm not saying that if you don't honor your mom and dad, you're going to end up in jail. But you might end up with some friends that get you in trouble. Or married to someone who makes you miserable. Or you might lose your soul. Don't do what Ricky did. Don't ignore the pleadings of godly parents only to wake up one day down the road saying what he said. I wish I'd listened to my mom and dad. Learn from him. Learn from God. Well, finally tonight, one last application I want to make of the story is this. I think Ricky would want to say to us tonight, he would want to say that we need to be careful not to be fooled about sin. You can be headed back to 2 Samuel 11. We'll reference that in just a minute. You know, Ricky never imagined that his life would end up like it did. He never dreamed that things would turn out this way. I mean, when he started hanging with the wrong crowd of kids at school, he never imagined that just being with those kids would get him into trouble. And even when he began to experiment a little bit with alcohol and with drugs, that's all it was supposed to be, just a little experiment. He never dreamed that he would get hooked on that stuff and that it would become a lifelong, life-changing habit for him. And then when he was taking those seemingly small steps in the wrong direction, drinking when he knew he shouldn't do that, using drugs when he knew he shouldn't do that, even those first steps in the wrong direction, he never thought at that time that that would lead him completely away from the Lord into a life of complete rebellion during that decade of his 20s. And then even when he was as far away from the Lord as you could imagine and just living a very wicked and sinful life, he never imagined he'd kill somebody and end up on death row. He never dreamed that it would all cost so much. In fact, I think that sort of surprised him, because for a good period of his life, he did very, very bad stuff and he really didn't seem that much worse for the wear. I would remind you that Ricky didn't start smoking dope at 15 and end up on death row at 16. There's a lot of years in between where he did a lot of bad stuff, ran with terrible people, did every kind of drug, was as immoral as you could imagine, did all those kinds of bad things, and unless you really object to living in your car when you're down on your luck, his life didn't seem to be that much worse for him. You see, it just took one night. When all of the choices came together, the friends, the drugs, the lifestyle, under the wrong set of circumstances with catastrophic consequences. Now he's paid the ultimate price. It was interesting to hear him talk about what was hard about being in prison. I had presuppositions. I think if I was in jail, I'd be worried that that guy sleeping in the bunk next to me was going to cut my throat in the middle of the night. That kind of stuff goes on. He never talked about that. Never talked much about fearing for his physical safety. He talked a lot about not being able to hug his mother. He talked about how difficult it was never to be able to partake of the Lord's Supper. When you're in jail, you just don't get to insist on that kind of thing. He hated the shame and embarrassment he brought to his family. He would say to me, "What is my mom supposed to say when her friends ask, 'Whatever happened to Ricky? He never comes around anymore. Where is he now? What's happened to him?' How does a mama answer a question like that?" And he would look out the bars of the prison cell there in Walker County, and he could see the woods and the ponds that surrounded the unit, and he would wish that he could go camping again and fishing, things that he loved to do that he knew he would never do. And he would talk about living with a death sentence hanging over your head every day. He would develop friendships with people whose time would come, and one day his friend in the cell next to him, they would come and they would take him, and he doesn't come back. And as he spent time in jail and became more familiar with how the process works, he could watch the wheels of justice slowly grind away and his time get closer and closer and closer. And then there came that day in July in 1999 when he was notified of his execution date. He had received two dates prior to that that he didn't really worry about. This one he knew. He knew the process now. And he knew this was his date. And then there were those last 3 days that we spent together. And then the last day when he had to say goodbye to his mother for the final time. And then the last moments when he was brought into the death house and knew that he was but moments away from his life being over. I will tell you, folks, I've never seen anybody go through something like that. It was awful. Let me be clear that I'm not saying any of that because I'm trying to engender sympathy for Ricky. In fact, let me be plain in saying to you that he paid the price he deserved to pay for the crime that he committed. Every awful thing that we could list that happened to him while he was in jail, all of it, he suffered, he brought on himself as a consequence of his foolish choices. All I'm trying to get you to see is he never saw any of that coming. He never imagined that when he first started puffing cigarettes and sipping alcohol, that he would fall so far and that it would cost so much. And so if he could be here and he could stand in this pulpit and he could speak to this crowd, what he would say is, don't be fooled about sin now. Because we do fool ourselves about it. We think we can dabble in it just a little bit and not be hurt, only to find ourselves suddenly and unexpectedly swallowed up in its trap and paying way more than we ever thought we ever would and falling further than we thought we would. That's why I told you to go to 2 Samuel chapter 11, because that makes me think of the story of King David. Who would have thought that one simple moment of moral failure would have such disastrous consequences? Here is a man walking on the roof of his house and he happens to catch a glimpse of a woman bathing. At that moment, he makes his mistake. It's not a murder thing. He's not thinking about killing somebody. He sees this woman and he looks too long. A sin, to be sure. An understandable mistake, absolutely. Can you see a guy messing up that way? Who would have thought that from that simple mistake, all that grief and sin and evil and murder would come? But that's where it ended up. There were no thoughts of murder that night on the rooftop in Jerusalem, but that's exactly where it ended. How many people today learned that same lesson like David did, the hard way? I think about young people who believe that they can experiment with drugs and alcohol. They buy the cultural lie. That's just sort of a rite of passage. When you're growing up, you're supposed to experiment with that kind of stuff, only to find out that the experiment doesn't just stay an experiment. It becomes an addiction and a habit you battle for the rest of your life. Or people who think they can be recreational about sex, because even our government has said at times that young people are just going to be promiscuous and there's nothing we can really do about that. It's a terrible insult to young people that you absolutely have no discipline over yourself, but people say that. And so people buy into that and they live lives of immorality during their growing up years. They have sex with other people and they wind up finding their lives totally changed by an unexpected pregnancy or a disease. He would want to say something to us about that. He would want to say, don't be fooled about sin. It takes you further than you plan to go, and it costs you more than you would ever think you would pay. If there is a lesson in that, ladies and gentlemen, it is that we should be terrified to wander out on sin's slippery and uncertain slopes. Don't be fooled. It is not cheap. The psalmist said in Psalm 34 and verse 12, you must do these things to enjoy life and have many happy days. You must not say evil things and you must not tell lies. Stop doing evil and do good. Look for peace and work for it. That's the lesson. Let's get ready to sing the invitation song. Thank you for your good attention tonight. The point of this lesson is not to say that everybody who runs with a bad crowd or ignores good, godly counsel or who foolishly steps out into sin, that everyone who does that would end up on death row. If that was the case, I probably wouldn't need to preach a sermon like this. I want you to understand tonight that Ricky's greatest fear was not of death as much as that was a looming reality for him. Ricky's greatest fear was of the second death. that after he died physically, that he would be unprepared to face God in judgment, and as a result of that would be separated from God forever in hell. Now that terrified him. And if we could end this lesson on a bright note, it would be to say that for the rest of his days, for the 11 years he spent on death row, he determined to prepare himself so that he would not face the second death, so he'd be ready to stand before God in judgment. But the truth is, brothers and sisters, Ricky's not the only one facing a death sentence. Every one of us face a death sentence. Every one of us who is of an accountable age has made the choice to violate the law of God and do things that we know are wrong. And as a consequence of that, we are facing the second death, the danger of being separated from God forever when this life is over. But the great thing about being a preacher is we have good news to preach. And that is, in Jesus Christ, we've been granted a reprieve. Jesus came to be the sacrifice for our sins so that when we believe in Him and we obey Him and we're baptized into His blood, we can be cleansed from all of that sin and we can escape the second death. Jesus gave us a reprieve. What should get in your mind eye this evening? A man, a condemned man on death row, being taken to the Huntsville unit and strapped up to that gurney, and they're about to inject the chemicals that will put him to death. And all of a sudden, moments before that begins, there's a phone call from the governor, and there is a phone there. And he says, I've heard this man's case, and I've decided to show him mercy. I'm going to give him a reprieve, take him off the gurney, send him back to the prison unit. And they come in and they announce the good news, and the man says, well, you know, we're all here, and they've gone to all this trouble. It just seems silly not to go forward. Forget the reprieve. Go ahead and execute me. Someone says, that would never happen. Why, only a fool, a crazy person would make that choice. You sure? Because we are facing our own death sentence. And in Jesus Christ, we've been granted a reprieve, not from physical death, but from eternal death, the second death, separation from God forever in hell. In Jesus, we've been granted a reprieve. And that there might be someone in this crowd tonight who hasn't received that reprieve, and you would leave tonight without accepting the salvation that Jesus offers? How much more foolish would that choice be? God's calling. He wants to give you salvation. He wants to give you reprieve. Are you ready to confess your faith in His Son as your Savior? Are you ready to say, I'm going to live my life for Him? Are you ready to obey His command and be baptized for the remission of your sins? If you do that tonight, you can go away clean, free from the penalty of the second death. Do you want that? You let us know by coming to the front. Come right now while we stand and while we sing together.